Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout.com, a gathering place for people who love movies. Sign up for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Well, look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Matty Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. This week, a Brothers Don't Shake, Brothers Gotta Hug edition of Film Spotting. We'll reveal our top five movies about brothers, even though we've decided to push our review of the movie that inspired the list, Wes Anderson's The Darjeeling Limited, to next week. And neither of us actually have brothers and thus have nothing interesting to say about the subject.
Plus, listener feedback, Massacre Theater, music by the Waco Brothers, Aren't We Clever, and a review of Ang Lee's latest, Lust Caution.
We may also find time for some of my quick thoughts on the new documentary, My Kid Could Paint That. But first, Maddie and I load up our six shooters for a discussion of two westerns currently in theaters, 310 to Yuma and The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Jesse James is bigger than you can imagine. And you'd go to him wanting to be with him. Wanting to be like him. You'd always come away missing something.
After finally catching up with 310 to Yuma this past weekend, I was thinking about the substantial differences between it and the Western we just heard a clip from, and I realized that their respective titles really say it all. The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford. It's long, grandiose, and despite all of the information it imparts, decidedly ambiguous. Who really was Jesse James? How was he assassinated? Why? Who was Robert Ford? Was he really a coward? In contrast, 310 to Yuma, which stars Christian Bale as an emasculated Civil War vet escorting Russell Crowe's ruthless outlaw to prison, is short, unpretentious, and specific, offering a set deadline with a set destination. Whether or not the trip will ultimately provoke as many questions, we can be sure it's going to present clearer answers, the way a good, old-fashioned Hollywood Western should. But The Assassination of Jesse James isn't a good, old-fashioned Hollywood Western. It's a revisionist Western in the mold of Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Sam Peckinpah's Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid, informed as much by its cinematic tradition as modern-day celebrity culture. Casey Affleck's Robert Ford is no different than any pop idol fan club president whose hero worship turns into destructive obsession. Maddie, as a critic, you're probably supposed to appreciate the ambitiousness of Andrew Dominik's revisionist take more than James Mangold's traditional one. Mm-hmm. Will you walk the line?
Unfortunately, I won't. 310 to Yuma is exactly, you hit it exactly on the head. It's just a movie without any pretensions about what it is. And Jesse James, unfortunately, it has some great things going for it. Great performances, beautiful cinematography by Roger Deakins. Saskatchewan never looked so good. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, you hit the nail on the head. It suffers from misplaced ambition on the part of the director. And it reminds me, actually, of the early 90s when Tombstone came out. Mm-hmm. And it's this summer blockbuster, fun shoot 'em up, big hit. Then later that winter, Wyatt Earp came out, which had these delusions of grandeur of being this sprawling melodrama. And it absolutely bombed. And to be fair, I don't think Dominik is attempting to make a Western. I mean, he's making a biopic, or as Sam Van Hogren would say, a biopic.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately, he adopts the wrong tenor here throughout the film. Every single scene, and there are so many scenes, waves upon waves of them, it's like Pickett's charge of extraneous scenes, is imbued with gravitas and importance. It's as though he thinks he's directing an Eugene O'Neill play. And the material just doesn't support that, and the end result is just exhausting.
I agree with you. I actually saw the film exactly the same way and do prefer 310 to Yuma as a Western and just as an entertaining film.
Yeah.
I was more drawn into the story, and I'm right there with you in terms of the things that Assassination has going for it. Roger Deakins, again, with great cinematography, and we saw it in The Valley of Ayla. He made that interesting to look at. He certainly makes No Country for Old Men, which we'll see again later, interesting to look at. And I really did like the shots with those blurred edges, like the old photographs. There's some really striking cinematography here. And I did actually really like the narration, the whole self-referential quality of it. I like the narrator's voice even, and I haven't looked up yet who it was, but I liked it.
Yeah, and you know, and it reminded me of a Ken Burns documentary,
yeah.
Civil War, along those same lines. But I think even there, there's a narrator telling us what's happening as it's going on.
Right.
It's just overkill.
It is overkill, but I actually think it worked in terms of adding something rather than just being redundant and saying what we're already seeing. But it gets back to this idea of Dominic toying with this idea of myth-making. I mean, it does set you up. That narration, I think, sets you up perfectly for a great legend. Some of what you're going to see is true. Some of it's false, but it's going to be a larger-than-life story. But at the same time, he is trying to deconstruct that. There aren't any epic gunfights here or showdowns. Everything unfolds very deliberately. That's probably putting it kindly, and very lyrically. And because of that lyricism, this film has drawn a lot of comparisons to Terrence Malick, Days of Heaven, and to the films I mentioned too, Altman's McCabe and Mrs. Miller and Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. And this is definitely a non-Hollywood movie. It's definitely challenging and ambitious in many ways, but it's not nearly as formally inventive or challenging as any of those films. I don't understand why everyone is insisting on making that connection when I see it, but at the same time, those films are all way ahead of this movie, I think.
No, exactly. The only thing that this has in common with Malick are those sweeping scenes, the beautiful shots of the prairies and so forth. And this movie starts off okay. Like, I like the gang that he puts together. And now we have to remember, this is the downfall of Jesse James. This is Jesse James. He's been stopped at Northfield. The younger brothers are gone. Most of his gang is gone. So he puts together this sort of gang that couldn't shoot straight for this one last robbery. And I really like those characters. Jeremy Renner, who we last saw in North Country as Bobby Sharp, is really good here. Paul Schneider is really good as Dick Little. And Garrett Dillahunt as Ed Miller, the sort of slow-witted character, but he knows a little bit more than he lets on, is fantastic here. And I think he's got a great career ahead of him as a character actor, sort of in the Dylan Baker mold, because he's also great in No Country for Old Men. He's going to steal a couple scenes in that. But yeah, we meet this gang, and we spend a lot of time with them. And when you think about it, about 2 hours into the film, you wonder, why did we spend so much time
with
them?
You're so right.
Their stories actually don't lead or affect what's going to happen.
Wow, and we haven't talked about this movie at all, but you are exactly right. It's those scenes that ultimately hurt this film for me, because there are some of those performances and some of those sketches of characters that I liked. You mentioned some of those great performances there. Dick Little, Paul Schneider, as you said, he's fantastic, but there are all these meandering scenes that we get with them that ultimately don't add anything to the story, the central story that's going on that I'm really caught up in, which is the story of Jesse James and Robert Ford. And so I think that Dominic clearly was trying to go for this sweeping kind of epic feel. So he had these dalliances, these scenes, but they just didn't add up for me and kept me at a distance. And I'll tell you what else kept me at a distance, despite some of the performances I really liked in some of those characters. Some of the performances in the film did ultimately hurt this film for me, and I'm talking about the lead performances, and I'll start with Brad Pitt. I know I've been on record. Yeah. I've railed against him many times, but even when you're trying to give us a portrait of Jesse James that runs counter to the legend, that revisionist take where he's beaten down and he's paranoid and he's lost some of his swagger, he still has to be charismatic. He still has to be the center of attention for the characters around him and for us, the audience. We have to see why people are drawn to him, why all those stories have been written, and why Robert Ford wants, as Jesse asks him at one point, to either be him or be like him. And I don't think Pitt ever demands our attention in that way.
I think it's really interesting. You have to remember, Brad Pitt has played Jesse James before. He's played a modern day Jesse James really well in Thelma and Louise and in the Ocean's movie, where he can be the cool bank robber. Mm-hmm. But Dominic doesn't ask that of him here. This is a guy beset right now by paranoia and to the point of derangement. And I like Brad Pitt, but he doesn't quite have the chops to pull this off.
No, he doesn't. And if you watch the first 30 minutes of the film, and I know I have harped on this before, but seriously, watch the first 30 minutes of this film and count how many times he either twitches his lips or pulls at his lips while he's smoking a cigar. I'm serious. I think Brad Pitt thinks that busyness equals charisma, and it doesn't. He's not magnetic at all, not in the way Warren Beatty is in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, not in the way Kris Kristofferson is as Billy the Kid in the Peckinpah film, Pat Garrett. And I said in our Toronto dispatches that I thought Casey Affleck really delivered a great performance.
He's terrific.
He constantly surprised me from scene to scene. He doesn't shy away from playing Bob Ford as a truly pathetic character. But the more I've thought about the film, Maddie, I have to say, the more I realize that maybe he goes too far with it. Even in that first scene we meet him where he talks to Sam Shepard as Frank James, at first we kind of like him. We can tell he's kind of an outcast. We like his ambition to be part of the gang, and we want him to succeed. But as the scene plays on and as the film goes on, he just becomes more and more annoying. We don't see why Jesse would want to keep him around. We don't root for him on any level. We just want him to go away. At least that's how I felt.
No, you're right. I don't understand why Jesse James would keep him around, but I think Casey Affleck actually pulls off some magnificent acting here. I mean, he's part altar boy, part naive youth, part 1880s Mark David Chapman. I mean, he does a great job of playing a guy with just something off about him. And you know, that's hard to do when your friend brings in a friend to the bar, and after 5 minutes of talking to him, you just don't know quite what to make about him. There's just something off about him, and that's what Affleck provides here. It's a mix of idolatry with zealotry. It's just, he's a powder keg waiting to go off, and you don't want him hanging around the locker room here when the athletes actually come off the field.
No, that's a great way to put it. And I agree. I really do, because watching his performance, I was always interested when he was on the screen. Yeah. It's only later when I'm thinking about why I've been kind of put off by the film, why it didn't really grab hold of me, and I realized that I never really felt for him in any way. I just wanted him to go away most of the time.
Because his reversal actually only comes in one scene. Ultimately,
it's
that
true.
Dinner scene, which is not done well.
No, it's not. And at the end, let's say, when we get to the end and we see the aftermath of the shooting, it plays out way too fast.
Right.
Some of that stuff is the most interesting stuff in the film, but Dominic has taken so long getting us there that there's not enough time for it. So it sounds like we are on exactly the same page with this film. And 310 to Yuma, I would say it's obviously less ambitious, but it is more effective. And let's just spend a couple minutes on Yuma here. If you've seen Shane, Maddie, or Once Upon a Time in the West, which, yes, listeners, I have now seen, you can fill in all the blanks of this film for yourself in terms of the son who looks up to the outlaw instead of his father, all the time spent worrying about a man doing what a man's got to do. And I fell for it all hook, line, and sinker, just as I fell for Russell Crowe as Ben Wade entering the pantheon of all-time great movie badasses. And it occurred to me that Wade in this film, Russell Crowe's character, is Jesse James, the myth, as opposed to the one the assassination presents. It's completely a myth. We don't believe it on any authentic level, but who cares? It's so much fun just to watch it until the end, as you hinted at last week.
Which we can't really discuss here, so I'm just going to praise the parts that I really love, and you really hit on it. It's the fact that everybody involved with this film is just having fun at playing cowboy here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think Alan Tudyk as the doctor is great.
He is.
Dallas Roberts as the company
railroad.
I love
this guy, Dallas Roberts, in everything.
He's a Juilliard-trained actor, and he's just magnificent in this, which is a role that would just go to Charles Martin Smith probably 15 years ago, but we stay with him throughout. And then, of course, there's this cameo that comes on in the middle of the film, and it just serves to remind you, yeah, these guys are just really, they want to be a part of this, and they're just having so much fun, and it's infectious to watch it.
It is, and you didn't even mention two of the performances that I also stood out. Peter Fonda. Unrecognizable Peter Fonda as this grizzled old Pinkerton, and he adds just that right note of grizzledness. And also, I've always really kind of liked this young guy, Ben Foster, and he gets to play Charlie Prince here, this homicidal sidekick,
the
assistant.
He is the prettiest villain you will
ever
meet.
And that's kind of what he's playing on, though. He's very feminine, and that's why he actually he has to be bigger than he is, and he has to be a little crazier, maybe, in order to scare people off. But there also is a sense of humor about it. It's not just this, hey, I'm a crazy guy, and watch me wreak havoc. There's a sense of humor about it, which I think is really great. They both kind of steal a lot of scenes that they're in, I think. And I just think that all we will say about the ending, I think all we can say is that it falls apart on so many levels. I wouldn't know where to start if this was a spoiler edition of it. Yeah. It really does practically, thematically, narratively, it doesn't add up. And I'm dying to go back and watch the original Glenn Ford version now, which I think is from 1957, to see how it resolved, because anything has to be better than what Mangold gives us here.
Yeah, it's just, and really, I can't talk about it. But just this prolonged, silly shootout at the end that just does not resemble the rest of the film.
It doesn't. It really does kind of make a mess of everything that's come before it, unfortunately. Well, 310 to Yuma opened wide September 7th, and it is still in theaters. We obviously recommend checking it out. The Assassination of Jesse James expands to more screens in limited release this weekend. If you've seen either film and agree or disagree with our takes, or if you have any other thoughts you'd like to share, please email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call 206-203-2463 and leave a voicemail.
Time for a quick break. When we come back, director Ang Lee goes from gay cowboys back to the only thing that might be scarier to mainstream America, subtitles. Stay with us.
There is this idea out there that abstract art and modern art in general is one kind of racket, is a put-on. And that if a child can do it, it sort of pulls the veil off this con game.
All I really want for Marla is to be a happy, well-adjusted kid.
People are asking about this art for real. They want to know who did it, and they want to know how much it cost.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. That was a clip from the trailer for My Kid Could Paint That, a really interesting, if flawed, documentary I caught in Toronto that opens this weekend in New York and L.A. I'll share some of my thoughts on it in a moment if we get there, but we really do want to devote the bulk of this segment to Ang Lee's new erotic thriller, Lust Caution.
Yeah, I think it's safe to say that Ang Lee is a film spotting favorite. He was born in Taiwan, received his BFA in theater direction just down the road from us at the University of Illinois. And I think what's amazing about Mr. Lee is his versatility and his diversity of subject, from the magical realism and surreal martial arts of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, to the gilded dysfunction on display in a suburban Connecticut living room in the 1970s in the ice storm. Lee has tackled everything from superheroes to the taboo of homosexuality in our westerns, and he's always managed to speak on this wide variety of subjects with an authentic and authoritative voice. In his latest film, Lust Caution, Lee returns to China, this time Japanese-occupied Shanghai, to tell the story of a young girl who joins a drama troupe, only to get enlisted in the resistance to play the most dangerous role of her life, that is, a mistress to the Japanese capitulator, Mr. Yi. Adam, does Ang Lee succeed once again in capturing the pulse of occupied Shanghai? And more importantly, does he bring his genius for specificity and nuance to the relationship between the dangerous Mr. Yi, Tony Leung, and Wong Chia Chia, played by Tang Wei?
Well, I think he may actually bring too much nuance and specificity if you really break it down. I mean, by the end, this film becomes muddled to a point where I couldn't keep up with all of the character motivations, and I actually stopped caring why the characters were doing what they were doing and the consequences of it. This film was 157 minutes long, and the problem is that it starts to become redundant. And you mentioned specificity. The opening scene is a good example of that and what is right and wrong with this movie. It's an extended scene of four women playing Mahjong, and Mr. Yi, Tony Leung, as you said, enters the room. And it's kind of mesmerizing, the speed of the game, the speed of their gossip and their dialogue, and it's setting up all of the central struggles of the film. The problem is that I think we catch on very early to this fact and don't actually need it to carry on as long as it does. Yeah. And I also think, as I said, where it becomes muddled narratively is in how we understand the main character, played by Tang Wei. Wong Chia Chi is her character's name in the movie, and we apologize in advance for butchering these names. But her motivations, without giving anything away at all, the end of the film becomes really problematic. She eventually has to act. She has to make a decision that we know she will have to make from the moment she becomes involved with Mr. Yi. And when she does, not only did I not believe her decision, I didn't care, and I especially didn't like the consequences of her decision. It essentially undid everything the movie had made me invested in up to that point. So I was underwhelmed by the film, and yet I do recommend the film because of some of the themes it explores, which we'll get to, and the amazing performances, I think, of Tony Leung and Tang Wei.
Yeah, I want to go on record. I'm really going to echo a lot of what you said, but I do want to say this is better than 70% of the movies that are going to come to your Cineplexes. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, this movie probably won't, because the MPAA, you know, in their crusade to save us from pubic hair, has given it an NC-17 rating. And I think it's absolutely ridiculous, but that's a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. You're absolutely right. If you were to walk into my office and bring me a treatment about this film, it's a great little thriller. Unfortunately, he doesn't get to that until the final third of the film. There's just too much exposition. You're absolutely right. He lingers in the drawing rooms of Shanghai far too long.
Yeah, I think he does. And the thing I liked about it, though, in those early moments, that what he is setting up is this really is a movie about performance, like any good undercover movie. Tang Wei is providing a performance within a performance as the character Wong Chia Chi and as Mrs. Mock. But what really drew me in is how the movie shows how acting and the theater can be really powerful and they can really move people and have an effect, but it's a far cry from actually acting, being active politically and getting yourself involved. Talking revolution and actually being part of the revolution are two different things, and that's why I think the film's graphic nature, sexually and in terms of the violence, actually really works. There's a moment where this group of actors, this drama troupe, as you said, they have to murder someone, and it goes really, really badly, and it's really messy. And that's the moment when they go from being these naive kids to people who actually have to get their hands dirty. And I think the whole film was kind of about that loss of innocence, and I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. And, you know, but also kind of one of the problems with the film is that, you know, I come from a theater background, and we know the moment someone with talent walks into a room and opens their mouth on stage, you know it. You know they're talented. And Tang Wei, the moment she enters into this group of conspirators, we're supposed to believe that she's this innocent seraphim-like creature. And unfortunately, She's not. She's cagier and better than all of her inept, you know, drama troupe, I think. And I think we spend too much time with that group because she's going to transform into this cutthroat spy.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, we linger with that group too much.
Maybe, but I think that in that scene where she has to transform herself on stage, and this is something where we have to believe as the audience that she's 100% genuine, that her performance could evoke the reaction that it does from her co-actor on stage, really move her actor and the crowd. And Ang Lee doesn't really bolster her in any way in terms of the direction. She has to deliver the performance, and she nails it. I mean, she moved me in my chair just reciting this propagandistic dialogue. It was really effective. And then the way she maneuvers between the two roles, that performance within a performance, transforming herself from the girl, which I thought was totally believable, into the woman, just through movements and raw nerve and body language, I really think this is one of those performances that it shocked me. It really startled me in how good it was. I actually think it's one of my favorite of the year so far.
Oh, she's brilliant. And we can't say enough also about Tony Leung.
No.
I mean, he's fantastic here as this sort of, I think Roger Ebert calls him the Cary Grant of Chinese cinema.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's absolutely fantastic. And the sex that they share, let me just say, it's not gratuitous. It's explicit, definitely. But it speaks so much to that relationship because at this all, it's an amalgam of a bunch of things. It is lust. It is danger.
Mm-hmm.
It is angry. And there are hands just running over each other. And you don't know if those nails are going to come out and they're going to rip into you, or they're going to caress you, or they're going to do both. And unfortunately, I think in the context of the film, the sex is going to be little more than a footnote.
Yeah, that may be true, but I absolutely agree that those sex scenes, and I give James Shamus, the producer of the film and the studio head in this case, a lot of credit for not making Ang Lee have to go back and recut this and not compromising, because it really does add something here. The scenes are hard to watch.
Yeah.
They're not that erotic, actually. They're brutal, and they're shocking in their graphic nature, I think, and maybe they're a little gratuitous in terms of, did we need as many of them as we get? I don't know, but they are clearly there in the service of the story, not to titillate.
Exactly. They speak volumes about this relationship.
They do. They give us some insight into the nature of the character's relationship, which I don't think we would get otherwise, and it really puts us inside her head, which is important. I still think by the end, it becomes very muddled in terms of the things we're seeing and we're inferring from these sex scenes, and then some of the decisions that she makes at the end, I don't know if they quite add up, or at least add up in a satisfactory way for me. But I do completely agree about Tony Leung as well, who I haven't seen on screen before be this terrifying or be that prone to be able to fly
but
off the handle and yet be reserved.
Sympathetic, too. I mean, and there is there is a sex scene that can't help but be described as rape. And after that sex scene, you still feel sympathy for this man. Yeah, he's evil, but he's also just a sad, pathetic character.
That's nicely put. I don't know if I can say I had any shred of sympathy for him,
but
you're right.
Did.
He still is that man. He still is someone that we pity in a way. I think that is there, and that's there in the performance. And he is incredibly charismatic by being this guy who just doesn't let anything out until the moment comes when he has to let something out.
Yes.
And then you latch onto it because you're like, oh, he's human after all. But there is some humanity to him, and he's seductive and he's terrifying. And again, it's just about betraying just enough emotion to kind of lure someone in without giving them any information.
Both
and
of
he
them.
Does
and
that
that's,
so well.
And that's how beautiful that is that both of them are doing the exact same thing.
They are. You're right.
They're entrapping each other.
Yeah. So I think this is a film that I can say I liked. I can say it's one I recommend, certainly for some of the performances, some of those themes that I mentioned. I love the performance aspect
and
of it.
And it's absolutely gorgeous, too.
And it is gorgeous to look at. There's no doubt about that. The cinematographer, Rodrigo Prieto, who also shot Brokeback Mountain, here doing some completely different things, completely different environment, but very effective nevertheless. So I think we both recommend it, but would be a little bit disappointed by the end of it. It's true, as I said, that I just started to be less and less engaged in the characters and their motivations and what they were trying to accomplish.
Yeah, unfortunately, we had a little bit of a different experience there because my mind actually started to wander in that expository first section, and I actually got involved in when it becomes the thriller, like what is going to happen.
Okay, it is just the opposite for me. The thriller aspect of it then started to not quite mesh as well with the beginning. So that's Lust Caution. We do have a few minutes here, Maddie, to spend on My Kid Could Paint That, and unfortunately, you didn't get a chance to see it. No, I'm not relishing the fact that
go
I get to
right
talk
ahead,
for two
Adam.
Minutes
go
here.
2 minutes. I cede my time to the honorable gentleman from Illinois.
We all know how our listeners enjoy hearing me go on and on, Maddie, but I'll try to be brief because I do think it is worth mentioning this film, and this is a film where the director and producer, Amir Bar-Lev, set out to explore modern art. there's always been this huge debate, of course, going back to Jackson Pollock and what he was doing and whether it really truly was art, like we heard in the trailer coming into the segment. If a kid can do it, then it's like Exhibit A in the case against modern art. It's really just a con game. So you've got this amazing story of this four-year-old girl in Binghamton, New York, Marla Olmsted, whose paintings are all of a sudden going for thousands of dollars, and she's appearing on TV shows left and right, and companies like Crayola are calling about endorsement deals, and the media is just eating it up. And then 60 Minutes does a piece on Marla, and Charlie Rose, my boy Charlie Rose, raises the question, 60 Minutes 2, I think, Charlie raises the question that Marla may not actually be painting these pieces by herself. An adult, likely her father, is helping her, and this causes this huge media backlash and also changes the focus of the documentary completely to this kind of investigation about whether Marla is really doing the work herself, because this guy, this director, has been shooting hours and hours of footage just assuming that when she's painting, it's the same thing that's ultimately adding up to these paintings that are being sold without really questioning it. And then all of a sudden, 60 Minutes kind of shatters his world as well. It's really fascinating stuff in terms of raising questions about what is art and about parenting even, how to handle a prodigy like this, and the media. But I do have a couple issues with the film that kept me from totally embracing it, and I'll just mention the two big ones. The first one is, when the 60 Minutes piece airs, the family and the people close to them feel tremendously betrayed. As you might imagine, they let 60 Minutes in, and then all of a sudden their world is shattered. But for the rest of the film, the director lets them get away with railing on 60 Minutes as if they did something totally unethical by raising the questions that they did. And he never challenges them on that notion that 60 Minutes was totally within their right. And I would argue they were. They, rather than regurgitate the, hey, isn't this cute story about this kid, they had an expert look at Marla's paintings and video of her painting. And the expert's reaction when she saw Marla physically painting was that it seemed doubtful she could have done the work that's being sold. It's not as if 60 Minutes came in, went to the expert and said, hey, let's cause a controversy and call Marla a fake. It just came out of the story. So that's something that bothered me. And lastly, he wanted to make this movie about modern art. And yet once it becomes this story of the four-year-old girl and whether or not she's really doing the work, he abandons that exploration because the fascinating question still at the core of this is whether she did it or not is, okay, so a guy who runs a Frito-Lay plant, a manager at a Frito-Lay plant, is painting work that that same expert said could be hanging in the Museum of Modern Art. If you really can just then throw those paintings in the garbage because a four-year-old didn't do them, then how can you make that mesh with the fact that you previously said they belong in a museum? There's something still really interesting there about anybody creating this art beyond this girl creating the art, and the director doesn't choose to explore that at all either. So the fact that I'm quibbling with these kind of big issues, though, I think gets at the fact that the film on the whole works and raises a lot of fascinating questions, but those were the big issues I had with it. I still say if you get a chance to see My Kid Could Paint That, you should definitely check it out.
Is it opening in limited release now? Or
it is actually out in limited release. I think maybe just New York right now, maybe L.A. as well, but obviously, it will hopefully expand at some point, if not, maybe check it out when it comes to DVD. So, Lust Caution's out now in limited release, and as I said, My Kid Could Paint That. Maybe you can catch that for our listeners in New York and L.A. Let us know your thoughts if you get a chance to see it. Feedback@filmspotting.net.
Yeah, My Kid Could Podcast That. Time for another quick break. When we return, Massacre Theater and your feedback on last week's top five senior citizen performances. Please stay with us.
Oh, yeah, we've been here before. This is what we do. No matter how hard you try.
Time now to take a look at what's new on DVD coming out this Tuesday. A couple of interesting releases this week, Maddie.
Yeah.
I think the one I would want to start off with, you haven't seen it yet, so you can't actually weigh in on the battle that Sam and I had, but 28 Weeks Later is out now on DVD. It does include an audio commentary by the director and co-writer, Juan Carlos Fresnadillo. Apparently, he got out of the coffin Sam built for him so he wouldn't direct anymore. It also has deleted scenes with optional audio commentary. So 28 Weeks Later is out now. I definitely recommend checking it out. Maybe a movie we don't recommend checking out, even though, in fairness, we haven't seen it. Evan Almighty.
Wow, this one really came and went. That's Steve Carell, right?
Steve Carell, and it was maybe, I think, the biggest budget for a comedy of all time, and it was just a disaster.
Wow.
Yeah, right. So that's a film we haven't seen and probably won't end up checking out. The Hunchback of Notre Dame is out now, a special edition of that. It includes behind-the-scenes footage of Lon Chaney out of makeup on the set, among other extra features, so that might be worth seeing. I also definitely wanted to highlight this one, Maddie. Mala Noche, the Criterion Collection. This is a new restored high-definition transfer supervised and approved by Gus Van Sant. Mala Noche, his first film. So a lot of other extra features there.
I have not seen it. I will be renting it.
You know what? I haven't seen it either, and that's why I'm looking forward to it, especially now out in Criterion Collection. Two others worth mentioning quickly. Rain Over Me, a movie Sam and I did both like, though we didn't love, with Adam Sandler and Don Cheadle, and that's out now with some extras. And Ken Burns' The War, which has just been playing on PBS, and my wife and I got caught up in last night when I should have been preparing for the show.
I've been watching everything.
Yeah.
It's fantastic.
It is. It's impossible to take your eyes off it once you get started. So that is out now as well. Ken Burns' The War. We do want to take a moment to thank everyone who donated to Film Spotting this week. There is a donations link, a text link you can find in the right rail of filmspotting.net. We really do appreciate all of your generosity. And Maddie, unleash the Sam Van Halgren nicknames.
I will do my best. Here we go. Alex, Strategic Reluctance. Karen, Blood Diamonds Ain't No Way to Treat a Lady. And Diane, Send in the Frowns. A very nice tie-in, I think, with our Ingmar Bergman.
There you go, Smiles of a Summer Night. Thank you again to everyone who donated.
I don't want to be a loser.
You're not a loser. Where'd you get the idea you're a loser?
Because Dad hates losers.
Whoa. Back up a minute. You know what a loser is? A real loser is somebody that's so afraid of not winning, they don't even try. Now, you're trying, right?
Yeah.
Well, then you're not a loser. We're going to have fun tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Welcome back to Film Spotting. It's time for Massacre Theater, the part of the show where Adam and I massacre a screenplay and you, the listener, get a shot at a free DVD. Now, last week, Adam and I massacred Little Miss Sunshine, a tie-in with last week's top five senior citizen performances.
Yes, a film that many people noted we never would have been able to do had Sam still been here on the show because he does dislike that film. But we both liked the movie, though it is true, number of people had to get their digs in, didn't they, when they wrote in?
Overrated.
Say it was overrated, but we do like it, as did many more listeners. A lot of people really liked your performance last week, Maddie. I give you props for that. Very subtle Alan Arkin.
Well, let me say something. It's very flattering that people liked it, but one listener got it exactly right on the head. I'm glad a lot of people thought I was doing Alan Arkin. Actually, I was doing a really bad Cher.
Okay. There you have it, the secret to great Massacre Theater acting. Maddie just shared it. Also worth noting, a record number of entries. Maybe not a surprise since so many people commented on how easy it was. We knew it would be easy. We're going to try to make it a little bit harder
this week.
We'll
All
see.
All right, Adam, reach into the Film Spotting hat and pick out this week's winner.
And the winner is Len Lipkin from Philadelphia, PA.
Oh, Philadelphia.
The city of
brotherly
love. The city of brotherly love, man. That's a perfect tie-in. We swear it's totally random, but Len has been a longtime listener. I'm glad to see he got a win. Congratulations, Len. Email feedback@filmspotting.net, and we'll set you up with a DVD of your choice.
I'll say action, Eddie. That'll be your cue, right? You come through the door, you walk right over here to the desk, to Amber, and push it.
Moving on now to this week's edition of Massacre Theater, and there really is nothing to say about it. We're going to try to make it a little harder. The connections will be obvious.
I think so. There's a couple connections here. I like
there
it.
Are.
We're playing on a couple different levels.
And now here you are giving hints.
Yeah, well, okay. Pretty abstract.
Well, you're going to start it off, so for once, I get to play director, and I'm going to be ruthless. Maddie, action.
Brother! Well, look at you. Boys, this is my big brother, the professor.
Gentlemen.
Come on.
Thanks for coming to see me last night.
Yeah, damn. Sorry about that. Wanted to be there. Wanted to hear the old man say, Blank, could you come into the study, please? Jeez, the professor. We should celebrate.
A little early for me.
The East is making you soft.
Is that right?
And
scene. All right, if you know what film Maddie and I just massacred, email your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net by Wednesday, October 10th. The winner will be selected randomly from all the correct entries and announced on next Friday's podcast. To listen and to get official Massacre Theater rules, visit filmspotting.net.
Hello, my name is Adam Kempinar from Chicago, Illinois. I like to pretend that I'm a film critic, but I've never seen On Golden Pond. I guess I need to get some homework done. All right, Adam, this is your old buddy Kevin Crossman from Fremont, California. This is your homework assignment for the week. You need to go see On Golden Pond. It is really a good movie. Excellent, excellent performances all around, you know, from all the generations in that movie. It'll make you cry. It'll make you laugh. It'll make you swear at your grandfather. It's just a great movie. Talk to you later.
As we get into listener feedback, Maddie, we start off with a great voicemail there from our friend Kevin Crossman chiding me for not seeing On Golden Pond. It's true. I haven't seen it, and he wasn't alone in making fun of me just as you did last week.
It's worth it alone just for the terrific performances.
That's what a lot of people say, and I can't admit that I did go out and rent it. It is at home. Didn't have a chance to fit it in, but I will see it, hopefully before next week's show.
Get the whole family together, sit on the couch.
There you go.
Sarah's going to love it.
Okay, she may love it. I will see On Golden Pond, I promise. But before we get into more feedback related to our top five last week, senior citizen performances, and also a little bit of discussion on Into the Wild, the new Sean Penn film, we did want to get into our poll question, starting with last week's question. And we asked you about Wes Anderson with the Darjeeling Limited coming out. We were planning to review it this week, but we've decided to push it to next week. We want to know what you think Wes Anderson's best film so far is. And Maddie, the choices were Bottle Rocket, Rushmore, The Royal Tenenbaums, or The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou, or none of the above. He's overrated. How did it come out?
Oh, this is a close one. Rushmore takes the cake at 33%. The Royal Tenenbaum second at 32%.
Only five votes separating them.
Yeah, wow. None of the above. He's overrated. Only 14%. Bottle Rocket, Sam Van Hogren, Are You Listening, comes in at 11%. And then nobody likes The Life Aquatic except for 9% of our voters.
Well, and we are with them on our dislike for that film. And worth noting, another Sam reference. Sam is listening to the show because he sent in some feedback about your review of Eastern Promises. I believe it started out, Maddie, let me be the first to tell you, I hear what you're saying, but you're completely wrong.
Yeah, nice.
And
thank
he
you.
Was right. So this poll question, though, I was maybe not surprised that Rushmore came out the winner, but I thought more people were maybe in that Sam boat with their love of that cult film Bottle Rocket. I thought it would finish higher than 11%.
Yeah, I really did not expect the Royal Tenenbaums to come in second. And you're right, I thought Bottle Rocket, I thought Rushmore would take it, but I thought Bottle Rocket would be right up there.
Okay, well, I am a fan of Royal Tenenbaums, as you were a little bit shocked to hear last week, so I'm glad it's up there that high. This week's poll question, you can vote on filmspotting.net. We're asking you about George Clooney, speaking of big actors and related to Brad Pitt in many ways, of course, do
and
a lot of
films
together.
You don't like George Clooney.
I'm not a big
Clooney
guy either.
You don't like Pitt.
I don't. You're right. And yet, I love Ocean's 11, but maybe because of Steven Soderbergh. But we want to know what you think about Clooney, and we're asking you about Michael Clayton, which we're planning to discuss next week on our Chicago Film Fest show. Michael Clayton star George Clooney is?
Is George Clooney an excellent actor, a solid actor, a merely okay actor who makes good choices, or is he flat-out terrible?
And my vote is a merely okay actor who makes good choices. Maddie, you are the actor. Yeah. Tell us what you think of George Clooney.
I think he's a solid actor. And the thing is, I don't think George Clooney himself would profess to be anything other than a solid actor. And he does make solid choices. He picks his own material. I think he's a man to be admired.
Okay. I'm not saying he's not to be admired. I'm just saying more often than not, I'm not enamored with what he's giving me on screen.
Well, what did they say? Was it Dorothy Parker said about Katharine Hepburn? She had all the range from A to B. I think, you know, I think you could safely say that about Clooney sometimes, too.
Maybe so.
He plays it pretty close to the vest.
He does. Okay, well, we did want to share one email we got here in response to our review of Sean Penn's new film, Into the Wild. Maddie, why don't you go ahead and start us off? This is Nick in Chicago.
Nick in Chicago says, gotta disagree with the positive reviews of the new Sean Penn film, Into the Wild. I read the book while I was living in Alaska a few years back and went both ways on McCandless Supertramp. He's both an unflinching idealist and a completely unprepared moron. Regardless of my own opinions of McCandless, Penn's version of the story was too slow, too heavy-handed on the materialism of Chris's folks, and not enough Alaska. While making Chris into a hero, Penn ignores most of his flaws. There were others he omitted about being frightfully unprepared for heading into Alaska in April. I realize this kid likely has a lot in common with the film's director, and Penn is rumored to have lobbied for the script for years, but come on, too much. Also, Penn omitted arguably the most touching part of the book when Chris's mom makes herself visit the bus where her son died. If memory serves me correctly, she left a plaque memorializing her son, a crate of supplies for lost hikers, and a note that reads, "Call your mother," which I have to admit, my God, is getting a little dusty here.
It is getting a little dusty. It's a great scene, but I have to say in response to Nick that I'm very glad that scene isn't in the movie. It's just those kind of sentimental moments that Penn omits that I think the film is better for. And again, while maybe in the book that would have been a beautiful and touching scene, I think actually where it ends is perfect. I think with McCandless's last kind of declaration is a perfect ending to the film. So We certainly hear what Nick is saying, though. A number of people wrote in and supported him on it. We knew we were kind of going to be out alone a little bit on this film. I mean, I think critics generally are behind it, but it is the kind of movie that I can see putting off a lot of people.
Exactly.
So
we also got a lot of great feedback on our top five senior citizens, including this one from Donna in Canada.
Yeah, Donna Cuff. She has a great top five list here. She says, number one, Richard Harris in Cry the Beloved Country. He turned 65 that year, and as always, I could sit and listen to him read the want ads. His thoughtful and most times subtle emotional acting mesmerizes me, including his small role in Gladiator and his character of Dumbledore in the Harry Potter films. Great pick. Number two, Clint Eastwood, Million Dollar Baby, such a talented actor and director, a great life's work, and he's still going. Number three, Dustin Hoffman, Moonlight Mile. Number four, Jack Nicholson for both The Departed and About Schmidt. He turned 65 that year. And number five, Morgan Freeman, An Unfinished Life, a movie I haven't caught up with yet. Donna writes, I love so many of his performances, and he's one of those actors that I will see a movie just because he is in it. Shawshank Redemption is one of my all-time favorite films, but unfortunately, he was only 57 in that one. So any names stand out there for you?
Richard Harris is just a great pick. Cry the Beloved Country, just a phenomenal performance. But I don't remember him in Gladiator.
I do remember him in Gladiator, and yet I don't remember the role he played.
I remember Oliver Reed in that film.
Yeah, I remember Oliver Reed, too.
Who might have qualified.
He may have qualified. You're right. I think that was Oliver Reed's last performance before he passed away. But I don't remember either. We will have to look that up. Why don't you take this next one, Maddie, from Wayne Wilentz in Montgomery Village, Maryland.
Right, the suburbs of D.C. Great call on Ruth Gordon's exacta of Rosemary's Baby and Harold and Maude. Don't forget her pre-Alzheimer's classic, Where's Papa, for the trifecta in the same period. And I know it's in the Pantheon, and damn well should be if it isn't, but Chinatown's John Huston is one of the most convincing and complex performances I can remember. And if Adam was allowed to sneak in a 64-year-old, which he wasn't, why can't we use Elder Huston Walter in Treasure of the Sierra Madre?
I love Walter Huston in Treasure of the Sierra Madre, as I love John Huston in Chinatown, and it is Pantheon, so I couldn't use it, but he was my number six pick. He really was. Even though it's such a small role, that was another reason why I wanted to leave it out, but how can you forget him calling Jack Nicholson Mr. Gitz? The future Mr. Gitz. I love John Huston as an actor. He's even great as God and as Noah in the Bible. So John Huston's always a lot of fun to watch for me. Let's move on to this one from Michael Bell, who writes in. He's got a really good top five here. He says, number one, Philip Baker Hall. Start in Sydney, a.k.a. Hard Eight, of course, and he says, what can I say, guys, except that your failure to include Philip Baker Hall on either of your lists was a major oversight. He's a force of nature in Sydney, hilarious in Boogie Nights, and bravely assumed the role of a reformed child-molesting game show host in Magnolia. I agree. I considered him strongly. I love Philip Baker Hall.
I think he's absolutely fine at what he brings to the table, but I really think he hit his peak as playing the library cop on Seinfeld.
Okay, well, I don't know how to follow that up, Maddie. Michael's number two, John Wayne. He says he would have gone with The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, but he was only 55 at the time, so he's going with The Shootist. Number three, no surprise, Clint Eastwood for Million Dollar Baby. His number four is a great one here, another one I'm sure we both considered, Walter Brennan for Rio Bravo.
I love Walter Brennan.
Yeah, he really is fantastic. He says, let's face it, this is Walter Brennan doing what Walter Brennan does best, except this time he's 65 years old. Red River Rio Bravo fans will forgive my pun if I refer to Brennan as Howard Hawks' reliable indentured servant for comic relief. And number five, this is one that came up. We had to get this mentioned in. Yeah. I really do feel bad about it as an oversight. Number five, Ellen Burstyn for Requiem for a Dream. She was 68 at the time. Michael writes, I don't have much to say about the performance except that it marks a much welcome return to form for a great American actress. Burstyn goes out on a limb for this one, and it pays off. I actually think I just overlooked her because I didn't think she was 65 at the time.
Yeah, I didn't think so either.
Otherwise,
but a lot of people echoed that sentiment.
Yeah, and deservedly so. I love that performance. Now, I thought she deserved Best Actress that year.
We have to mention his number six.
We do. Go ahead.
Patrick Crenshaw, born 1919. You guys will know him as Joseph Blue Pulaski in Old School in 2003. It's glorious.
It is a classic, glorious performance. A great choice there. Lastly, Maddie, let's close this segment out with El Duderino in Lisbon, Portugal. And I actually want you to go ahead and read it here. But he wrote in about our top five last week where we talked about Milos Forman. We read a top five from T.J. Wells, I believe, who said Milos Forman maybe belonged in that overrated director's list. And El Duderino here wrote in something that was echoed by a number of people, and we feel, as a maybe a little mea culpa, we should point out.
Well, we are constantly being shown how much more cultured our audience is than we are.
That's been obvious since the beginning of Film Spotting.
But the Duderino does write, I don't want to get into whether he's overrated or not, but please don't talk about Milos Forman's career as if it started with Cuckoo's Nest. Movies like Loves of a Blonde and The Fireman's Ball, which he made early in his career in his homeland of Czechoslovakia, are still highly regarded today and were probably the reason why he got to work in the U.S. in the first place. Very well put.
It is very well put. Again, a number of listeners wrote in about that. We have overlooked those films because we haven't seen them. Whether or not you still think what he's done since Cuckoo's Nest and those Czech films is worthy of maybe including him on an overrated list, the fact is we haven't seen those films, and so maybe shouldn't have thrown him into the fire just yet. So we do appreciate that. As always, if you've got feedback for us, email us at feedback@filmspotting.net or give us a call, 206-203-CINNA, and leave a voicemail.
Okay, time for one last quick break. I knew it was you, Adam. You broke my heart. Our top five movies about brothers are up next. Stay with us.
The champagne's still on ice. Might as well down it tonight.
Film Spotting's Top 5 is presented by Spout.com. Share your lists, reviews, and discuss movies with your friends for free at filmspotting.spout.com.
Of course, I'm an excellent driver.
You know how to drive?
Yeah.
Right now! You never touch the steering wheel when I'm driving. Do you hear me?
Yeah.
Do you hear me?
Of course, I don't have my underwear.
You're listening to Film Spotting with Adam and Maddie, and that was a clip from Rain Man, a film that will not make either of our top five lists, movies about brothers, but certainly could have, movies that are about the bond between brothers, and you're over there doing your Dustin Hoffman right now. Unfortunately, our listeners can't see that, Maddie, but these have to be movies that aren't just featuring brothers, such as The Blues Brothers, for example, but movies that really do deal with the relationship, I think, in some way between brothers.
And I went one step further. I tried to find a conflict between the brothers. And I'm thinking there's got to be an obvious one that I missed where, you know, one brother is the sheriff and one brother is like the outlaw. There's got to be like five or six movies, and I just couldn't think of one for the life of me.
Well, I'll give you one that I consider that almost falls into that, and that's Winchester 73, a movie we watched in our Westerns marathon where James Stewart is the good guy chasing after the bad guy, and then, of course, we find out later that they're brothers.
That's
so
right.
And he's after him because he killed his father. So Winchester 73 almost falls into that, but this is our I Knew It Was You, Fredo, Godfather 2 Memorial List. Maddie, what's your number five?
My number five, 1991, John Singleton's Boys in the Hood. I mean, one of the first films to examine the issues facing black teenagers growing up in the hood in modern society. Two brothers, I think they're half-brothers, actually. Ricky, played by Morris Chestnut, he's trying to get a scholarship to school. And the other, Doe, played by Ice Cube, really falls victim to the world of violence and gangs around him.
Certainly one I considered a movie I like a lot from John Singleton. My number five is a Robert Altman film, Vincent and Theo, from 1990.
I have not seen it.
Great film about Vincent van Gogh, obviously, and his brother Tim Roth and Paul Reiss in the film. And Theo is an art dealer who subsidizes his unstable brother and eventually has to put him in the care of a doctor. We've all heard that story before. But this is really that classic tale of one brother who has to live in the world as it is, and the other one lives in his own world, and the other one has to kind of take care of him. Long time since I've seen the movie, but I remember loving the performances. Tim Roth's performance in particular, and Robert Altman as the director, as usual, is great. So Vincent and Theo is my number five.
I'll have to check that one out. All right, well, my number four is Ron, or as we say in Minnesota, Ran. It's Kurosawa's 1985 classic retelling of the King Lear story set against feudal Japan, only, of course, instead of sisters, it's brothers. I love The Hidden Fortress and Seven Samurai even better than this film, but I think this is his most beautiful film, just majestically shot.
Hard to argue with that pick there. My number four, Maddie, you gave me a lot of grief over not including it in our poll question a few weeks back. I'm giving some love to Dead Ringers, the 1988 David Cronenberg film. Again, you thought I slighted it, and you were right. Loosely based on the true story of identical twin gynecologists who are very successful and happy, and then a woman gets involved, and their codependent worlds crumble into depression and drugs and misery and just surrealism like you would expect from a Cronenberg film. This is another film where it's been a long time since I've seen it, but I remember Jeremy Irons being brilliant in the dual role as brothers Elliot and Beverly. I remember a lot of red, and I remember a lot of really scary gynecological tools. It is a great psychological horror movie, though. I think Dead Ringer is my number four.
All right, and I just caught up with that last weekend, so I can honestly say, and listen to this, all you Cronenberg lovers, I really like that film.
You did. I did. Fantastic.
All right, well, my number three is one that you can actually check out on DVD. I just did. It came out last year, and that's Ken Loach's The Wind That Shakes the Barley. A fantastic film. It will be on my top 10 films of 2007. It's the story of two brothers caught up in the IRA's campaign against Britain in the early 1920s. Cillian Murphy plays the more reluctant revolutionary Damien. Padraig Delaney plays his more zealous brother Teddy. And after terms of peace are eventually sued for, the two brothers face off in sort of the ultimate test of brotherhood. Easily one of my favorite movies of the year.
One I still have not seen. I have it home on DVD and can't wait to catch up with. My number three is a movie that came out just a few years ago, one of my favorite films of 2005, and that's The Proposition.
Oh, good choice, good choice.
Thank you very much. I Want You to Kill Your Brother, Arthur Burns. That's my very bad Ray Winston impression, but it was one of my best films from that year. John Hillcoat directed, written by Nick Cave. It's set in the Australian outback in the 1880s, where the British are trying to impose some kind of civility, and you have the Burns gang, Charlie, Mikey, and Arthur, really 3 points on the spectrum. On one end is the innocent Mikey, on the other end is the sociopathic Arthur, and in the middle is Charlie, Guy Pearce, trying to sort it out, trying to save one brother's life by killing his older brother. It's dirty, it's violent, but it's really good, and I think Ray Winston as Captain Stanley and Emily Watson as his wife deliver two of the best performances of that year.
That's a great choice. Man, you're working on a couple different levels today.
I'm trying.
That's a great Western in itself.
Yeah, there you go.
Nicely done. All right, well, my number two, going back to 1968, The Lion in Winter. Henry II, played by Peter O'Toole, can't decide which of his three sons will inherit his crown, so he invites all of his sons and the King of France, and of course, Catherine Hepburn, who is absolutely brilliant as his queen, Eleanor of Aquitaine, and they all conspire trying to get the crown. The acting in this movie, which also includes a young Anthony Hopkins and a very handsome Timothy Dalton, is unbelievably superb.
Does Hepburn get to letter D or E with that role or not?
I'm not agreeing with Dorothy Parker. I think Catherine Hepburn is brilliant. You heard me sing her praises last week on Golden Pond, and she's even better in this film.
Okay, well, my number two, I do want to say, for people who may be new to the show, I want to remind people about our top five. We do have a pantheon where at least Sam and I, we haven't put any movies in there yet that you've brought to the table, and maybe
obviously
some
Major League would be up there.
Major League,
Midnight
of course.
Run.
Midnight Run would be in the pantheon, along with maybe bigger works such as Citizen Kane and The Godfather.
Oh, yeah. That's the sled movie, right?
Yeah, exactly. The sled movie. But we have this pantheon, movies that we deliberately omit from top five lists. Otherwise, they could be on virtually every top five list. And one of the films, for example, that I left out of my top five because it's in the pantheon, Raging Bull. I think you could make the case as a brother film very much about that relationship between
that's a good one. I didn't think about
LaMotta
that.
And his brother Joe Pesci there and Robert De Niro. My next two choices here are films that probably belong in the pantheon, but nevertheless, I'm for now including them. Let's go ahead and hear a clip from my number two.
You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short-end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum.
One of the all-time classic quotes in cinema history from On the Waterfront with Marlon Brando. Kind of like Vincent and Theo, as I said, this is one brother in the real world, the world of commerce, the other brother more of an idealist or someone who becomes a bit of an idealist. As you heard in that scene, part of that psychological torment that Terry Molloy goes through really relates to his brother and the choices his brother helped push him to make. Elia Kazan directed this film, a classic film, a great film. No, you aren't going to see East of Eden on either one of our lists, I don't think, or at least not on my list, because I actually think it's kind of brutal. James Dean, not such a good film, but this is about celebrating films. On the Waterfront is brilliant. It's my number two.
Well, I'm just going to echo what you said. It's my number one.
Really?
On the Waterfront. Yeah, and actually, I have a lot of love for this film because actually my first film class, this is the film we first read, and it is absolutely brilliant, but I also love it because it's an artifact of its time in that it celebrates the stool pigeon, and when you think about its director, Elia Kazan, he named names.
Yes, he did.
So, but yeah, it's a brilliant film.
Unfortunately, you can't really talk about any of Kazan's films now without putting it in that context
and unfortunately,
of the committee.
Unfortunately, I'm going to.
Yeah, no, I think that's perfectly reasonable. Everyone else does. Why shouldn't you, Maddie? So, well, I stole your number one. The fact is you stole my number one earlier. And as I said, it could rightfully go into the pantheon of all-time great films because I think it's that good. And it is Akira Kurosawa's Ron. It's only been in two of my top fives before. So anyone out there writing in saying, no, really, retire it. It really has only been mentioned twice before. But as you said, the King Lear story with sons instead of daughters and handing over his empire to the eldest kid and banishing his youngest son, even though his youngest son is the one who truly loves him and honors him. And they all end up in a battle against each other, betraying each other and the kingdom in ruins. I mean, when you think of brothers, when you think about fathers and sons, which is the top five, one of the top fives it previously made, Ron has to be on there. Just an amazing,
beautiful,
gorgeous, beautiful really is the word, especially with Kurosawa's use of color and some great war scenes in that movie as well. So Ron is my number one.
All right, great list. So those are our top five movies about brothers. Send your list or any other feedback to feedback@filmspotting.net. Again, that's feedback@filmspotting.net. You can also give us a call at 206-203-2463 and leave a voice message. All right, now opening wide this weekend, The Heartbreak Kid from the Farrelly Brothers. Adam, you're going to be seeing that one?
You're going to be first in line, aren't you, Maddie?
I still like the Farrelly Brothers. Feel the Noise with Jennifer Lopez and The Seeker, The Dark is Rising, a movie I'll admit I don't know anything about.
Me neither.
In limited release, My Kid Could Paint That and Michael Clayton, and expanding to more screens, The Jane Austen Book Club, which I can recommend, Assassination of Jesse James, which I don't think either of us really want to put you
through. I think we're maybe moderately. I'd moderately recommend it.
Yeah, there's a lot going for it. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, it's just kind of exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Lust Caution and the Darjeeling Limited, which we will be reviewing next week.
That is true. We will have our review of the Darjeeling Limited on next week's show. We'll also devote most of that show to the Chicago International Film Festival, where we'll discuss Michael Clayton, which you caught in Toronto, Maddie. It's one of the Fest Gala presentations, and we'll discuss some of the films we plan to see at the festival. Our top five will be the definitive list of Chicago movies.
All right.
And as we said last week, we do plan to have at least one featured guest on the show, so stay tuned to our calendar page or the Film Spotting message boards for updates.
And thanks to Alex and Angela on those message boards, Frank Cuckle and Candace Griffiths. Thanks also to Waco Brothers and Bloodshot Records for this week's music. Learn more at bloodshotrecords.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Maddie Robinson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is brought to you by Spout. Visit filmspotting.spout.com to discuss this episode.
Oh, there we go.
Testing 1, 2, 3. You hearing me loud and clear?
I'm hearing you very loud and clear.
Great.
I'm going to go with my sexy voice today.
Don't do that.
Why can't I do that?
Then I'll be way louder than you. That's why. I don't have a sexy voice. I just have full tilt band Adam.
This is a mind-blowing experience.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Wow.
Yeah.
Now I've got something else to work into. Terrific.
What were you saying? Sunshine State?
It's from Old School.
Oh, it is?
Denver. The Sunshine State.
Listeners will get that.